Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. I'm now here with Lone Wolf. And Lone Wolf is a blogger and, well, in fact, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Lone Wolf. I am a amateur writer and researcher. I'm currently running a blog at the moment entitled wolfofwodenblogspot.com. And I take interest in things like culture, metapolitics, a little bit of philosophy and history even there. And I'm also rather keen on making my own psychological observations and talking points.
All right. And you want to talk tonight about the European conservative revolution of the early 20th century and how it relates to, you think there are parallels between it and the dissident right today. So people, by the way, I should say first that people can, your blog is linked to, I'll do it on DLive just now, but it's there on, on YouTube, and here it is on DLive. Now, apparently on DLive, it still says Horace, so don't worry about that. That's just an annoying glitch. Hold on a second, I'll fix that now. But in the meantime, can you introduce people to the European conservative revolution? Because obviously a big thing here is that conservatism doesn't tend to go hand in hand with revolution. So can you explain that to people? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. As the title suggests of the movement, the conservative revolution, it sounds kind of like an absurd contradiction because obviously conservatism is anything but revolutionary. So the movement itself is quite aware of this, or the figures within this movement are aware of it. So it took place between the interwar years in Germany, so the Weimar Republic, 1918 to about 1930. And it was a kind of reaction against the Germans losing the First World War, and they went through a kind of identity crisis, and they were trying to look at certain values and principles, trying to figure out why they lost the war. So it kind of fermented an intellectual vanguard of the right, as it were. So this is basically spearheaded by people such as Oswald Spengler. I mean, sure. We're all familiar with him, Julius Evola, he was Italian, Ernst Junger, Carl Schmitt. And what these intellectuals had in common is that they were all inspired by Friedrich Nietzsche. So Friedrich Nietzsche doesn't need much of an introduction here in this movement. But what is quite significant about Nietzsche's philosophy with regards to the conservative revolution, shall I just call it RevCons, well, for the sake of brevity?
Yeah, it's okay.
That's okay. You're right with that, yeah. So the RevCons, they kind of tried to formulate a transvaluation of all values. So Nietzsche, in case anybody isn't familiar with Nietzsche's philosophy, Nietzsche was kind of nihilistic, not for the sake of being a nihilist, but he wanted to deconstruct traditional archaic principles from the past, which he thought no longer served Europeans or Europe, but he was very much a modernist in this sense. Now, what Nietzsche wanted to do was smash the old morality and henceforth with a brand new system of morality, one in which that could be more applicable to the current age. So this is what the conservative revolution is kind of founded upon. It's this foundational value. So it went looking into the future, it wanted to dismiss kind of archaic principles which no longer serve the 20th century. So it would be a case of a rejection of modernity, liberal principles, egalitarianism, parliamentary democracy. And yeah, it would just, they wanted to found this kind of simple system. But what's kind of intriguing about this RevCon environment is it is kind of similar, in my opinion, to the movement that we experience right now, the alt-right, the dissident right, however you want to define it. And I see many parallels here because we believe we are, you know, in a time of unfounded nihilism. Everything is extremely set up against us in Europe. were looking to overcome the wokeness, for the want of a better term. And I believe we can learn a lot from these very intellectuals of this movement.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the notion is that, well, what I wanted to ask you was about the, there was a drive towards egalitarianism. Do you think that goes at the start of the 20th century? Do you think that kind of goes hand in hand with modernity, with the end of, with a certain degree of comfort? And the, once you've got sort of industry in place, do you think egalitarianism kind of leads on, follows naturally from that?
Yes, I would say so. I would argue that liberal democracy is, it kind of facilitates a weak society, a weak man. And funnily enough, Ernst Jünger, who is the spearhead of what is kind of considered to be new nationalism within the same branch, he argued that modernity facilitates this weakness because an over-reliance on the human body makes everything centered around the human body. So if one is to experience physical or emotional pain, then that is the worst thing that a man could experience. Whereas he wanted us to transcend all values, he wanted to transcend to a higher order and create a warrior ideal and kind of ethos. So this kind of did go hand in hand with modernity. Yes.
It's funny how a warrior ideal and ethos, it just seems so out of place with a world of comfort and luxury. And it just seems to be off a different age. And I'm not saying that therefore it's wrong. I'm just saying you can understand why that is something that needs to be fought for, because luxury just says, well, we don't need war anymore. We don't need struggle anymore. We don't really need to care about much anymore.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You know, it's, as you say, without struggle, how do we cope with bad things that happen to us? How do we cope with physical pain? How do we cope with emotional trauma? It does appear that we are also entering a new age of this kind of hedonistic modernity. Yeah.
So what about the matter of religion? I mean, what was the RevCon, what did they have to say about the decline of Christianity? Because I know that Nietzsche obviously was speaking about that a very long time before it, well, I think it was the 1880s. So he noted then that Christian faith was in decline. And so what was the RevCon treatment of that matter?
Well, it was very inspired by that very same nihilistic approach from Nietzsche. Christian moral conservatism was, they deemed it to be moribund and antithetical to modernity. So you're absolutely right, but it wasn't explicitly religious in any sense. You could say it was kind of implicitly paganistic or some kind, even perhaps atheistic. But I don't think it's particularly relevant to their political views. But it was, yeah, it was a kind of a rejection of Christian morality for sure.
Okay, does this relate to the futurists in Italy with Marinetti? Because they were definitely against, slave morality, any kind of weakness or meekness. They were very much about power and strength and vigor.
There were parallels to fascism in Italy and even National Socialism in Germany, but it's not necessarily defined by that.
I meant futurism. That was a sort of art movement in Italy at the just before the First World War.
Right, I see. Yeah, I'm not too sure about that, to be honest with you. I mainly concentrate on the German perspective.
Okay. So, okay, well, what did it lead anywhere? I suppose that's an obvious question to ask. What was this something that just got washed away during the course of the 20th century, or did it? I mean, I know that you said it links to the Third Reich in Germany.
Yeah, it did lead to that. There was some kind of proto intellectual movements which took from it. I mean, there was a man called Merle van den Broek who was largely an unknown within the movement. Sorry, within the English speaking world. In fact, many of his translations, you know, not even in English, to be honest. But yeah, it was, it kind of died after 1945, to put it bluntly. So when
liberal, would you say, would you say, yeah, so I was going to say, so egalitarianism kind of won out then, yes, in this context.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was certainly a mini zeitgeist of sorts, which it, I wouldn't say it didn't lead to anything, but it, it kind of died off eventually.
And would you say that those, that its sentiments are now ripe for a revival? I don't want to put it in a cringy way, but I can't think of a different way to put it. It clearly, you know, we are now, or we have lived through since then, a period of extreme luxury and comfort and plenty, abundance. So I'm guessing you think that people are quite spiritually weak now as a result of that.
Yes, I would say so. I mean, as I say, I believe that we in this movement are the spiritual successors of this RevCon movement. And I would say that the luxuries post-1945 onwards have made us realize that we are still going through a spiritual awakening of who we really are, you know, how we are to be defined, how we can see ourselves in the future. And another thing about this actual RevCon movement is that it wasn't reactionary for the sake of being reactionary. It wasn't, it wasn't quite conservative how we view conservatism now. It was very much a movement of its time looking to the future. And these are the parallels I see with us in the dissident right, because we're not simply reactionary. We do want to formulate our own ideas. We want to know who we are. We want to go into the future. And we want to kind of define ourselves from there on, instead of constantly looking towards our enemies to see what they're doing, or to see what the pastor's doing, and so forth.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a need for that. I mean, we've talked about that quite a lot on Millennial this year, that the right has, is the slave of the left. The mainstream right just, yes, does what the left does, you know, 10 years later. So mm-hmm. that is, and then of course it also just see, it defines itself in opposition to things. So it's anti everything, but it's not really pro much. And I honestly don't know what you would say the Conservative Party today is pro. It's difficult to think of anything. It's pro-business. Well, that's not a USP anymore, because the left are pro-business now as well. So,
yeah. Well, yes, that is true. I mean, as you say, the modern Conservatives, what are they pro? They're pro-free market. They're pro not being racist. That's what they seem to be. Goes right back to David Cameron, and before him, what did the Conservatives do? What are they conserving? I mean, this is, I'm not saying anything original here. We all know this. But what kind of conservatism do we look for in the future? Because contemporary mainstream conservatism as we see it now, has no future. It's just merely existing. It's got a past, and it's living in the present. But if it's to define itself by not being as racist as the left perceive them to be, then what on earth is this? So, yeah, this is another reason why I think the RevCon movement can offer us something in this movement. I mean, a lot of people in our movement are familiar with the likes of Spengler, Schmidt, Heidegger, Junger. So the reason why I created my blog was to kind of add a reference point for anybody in our movement to say, look, all your stuff is there. There's the literature. I've compiled it all for you. We do have our own. There's another thing as well. There's a lot of talk in this movement of creating our own right-wing critical theory. And I'm all over that, because I don't believe you can go anywhere without intellectual thought. All action without thought. Well, you know, we've seen that happen in the past. Certain 70s factions. But this is kind of the intellectual foundation upon which real conservatism, genuine right-wing conservatism, in my opinion, starts in this particular movement.
I think you're right that there does need to be intellectual fuel behind anything. And I think that conservatism for a long time has rejected, has not had fuel, and it has rejected fuel from numerous sources. I'm just thinking that Roger Scruton, for example, tried to reinvigorate it with some direction, and mentioned conservatism, responded by, destroying him. Same thing with Enoch Powell, actually, in the late 60s. So I think it's, yeah, I mean, it basically has to be swept aside. It has to, I think they mentioned that what we know of as the Conservative Party has to either be just taken over, or it has to be replaced, I would say.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And you mentioned Roger Scruton too. He was kind of, he was not a normie conservative by our definition by any means. Because he was kind of, I don't want to use the term milquetoast, because he wasn't quite like that. Because he was all about the aesthetics of beauty and Gothic architecture. And he resonated with us quite a bit, I believe.
But yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, he kind of, his death, it kind of signaled an end to kind of milquetoast conservatism, just to use that term a bit rightly there. And yeah, it does represent a certain kind of end to something that just no longer works anymore. We have to be more forthright as a movement. We have to define ourselves not by our enemies, as I say, but make our own culture, our own principles, our own theories, and just kind of go into discourse based on that, instead of, as I say, looking towards the past.
Yeah, or trying to catch up with the left. I mean, another one that springs to mind, a similar sort of thing, is David Starkey, who used a phrase that about 6 months ago now. He, I think most people will know he's a TV historian. And in a way, he's a kind of success story for a lot of people, in the sense that he came from a very working class background, very deprived, became very learned, educated, and so on, and he was also, and he is also, a homosexual. So you'd think that he'd be a certain darling of the liberals for that reason alone, but that's clearly not enough. And 6 months ago, he used a phrase that, yeah, was indelicate, but I don't think it signified a more, you know, a more deeply racist attitude in him, but it was just an indelicate phrase. But that was enough to have him completely, I mean, his career's over. He's completely, he's gone. I haven't heard of him in 6 months. It's just like that. That's all. That's it. He is no longer a public figure. He's no longer a voice, an influence on anyone. He's been, you could say deplatformed, but from the mainstream. And I think this is, again, an instance of this where you either believe in things and stand for them, or you will die on your enemy's hill. You'll die basically trying to catch up with your enemy and emulate your enemy, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah, that absolutely is. You can't emulate your own enemy, because you become your enemy, or you become a mere shadow of that thing. So as for, yeah, I didn't know anything about David Starkey there. I mean, I have heard of him, but I didn't know he was homosexual or such.
Well, he's a historian, and he was on TV for many years, and he was on radio as a cultural commentator, right wing as well, conservative. He used he was talking about slavery, and he used a term just to refer to the number of black people in America, I think, or was it in Africa? I can't remember, but he said that slavery was not genocide because there are so many black people in existence today. And indeed, the population of Africa skyrocketed, certainly in the 20th century. That's after slavery. But anyway, the point is that the point he was making was it was not genocidal. Now, I don't care to argue yes or no on that matter. I'm just making the point that he has been completely unpersoned because there is no conservative establishment to back him up on anything. And as soon as he was demonized by the left, that's it. nobody was there to defend him. And so we've lost, the right has lost one of its key commentators for a ridiculous, spurious reason. The right has done its enemies work for it.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, conservatism now is synonymous with individualism, but it's not, it's pure liberalism, it's centrism. To be an individual liberal is to essentially, and I'm sorry to use this word, but it's quite parasitical. Because you are reacting from the higher order. You're very inactive. You've got no agency if you're a liberal, essentially, if you're a centrist. But with the RevCon movement, they were anything but individualistic. I mean, Ernst Junger, for example, and also Spengler had this term, socialism of the blood, which in German terms is Frontgemeinschaft, so a frontline socialism representing the authoritarian nationalistic state. It's kind of like Plato's ideal with the guardians and the auxiliaries and the ideals of the nation state. So it was a case of everybody is in this together. I mean, in the case of the RevCons, it was purely German-centric. It was, as I say early on in the stream, Germany went through an identity crisis. So they had to formulate their own collectivist brotherhood, if you will. But conservatism now, it's falsely attributed, essentially. I mean, as you mentioned with David Starkey, they just completely, nobody's there to back them up.
Yeah. And this happens again and again with conservative commentators. Whenever one of them steps a bit too much out of line, that's it. All the rest of conservatism just abandons him. Mm-hmm. It's just awful. But what the right ends up doing is just progressively, so to speak, weakening itself. So, yeah, I think it's ridiculous. There needs to be this backbone. And I think you're right that requires an intellectual body of thought.
Yes.
Which, in turn creates a certain spiritual strength and oomph, a certain joie de vivre that enables it to fight. There are some questions here. How important do you see Ernst Junger in the conservative revolution?
Well, with regards to the original conservative revolution, not the current one, he was very important. He's essentially the figurehead. He was kind of a strange character because he went from being a anarchist into a straight up liberal later on in his life. He was a highly decorated war veteran from the Great War. He was a very disciplined character, very matter of fact in the sense of his views towards war. I mean, some would say it's kind of misanthropic to have this warrior ideal, to glorify war and violence and pain. One of his essays is On Pain, which is a fantastic essay. I advise anybody in this movement to read it. He kind of argued for a Nietzschean intensification of the struggle, as it were, to kind of love pain and make it your home and not be put off by it. So I would say he is extremely important even today, because I don't see many people mentioning his name in our movement. And that's why I was keen on looking into it more, because I thought, well, this guy seems very based. And looking into him, yeah, he kind of is. But as I say, he's a little bit controversial in some respects.
All right. Somebody also asks, which works of Ernst Junger would you recommend?
Absolutely, Storm of Steel, which is his memoir from the First War. It's very, very stoic. It's not drawing on the emotions, unlike, the English perspectives, as it were. So that is a must. That is an absolute must. If you can, get the Mystery Grove edition, which is the 1929 translation from Basil Creighton. That one's got more nationalistic overtones to it. Also, as well, On Pain, as I said just there.
Okay. All right. Somebody else, and this is a bit unrelated, but it might, I think it is relevant. Is it accurate to describe, and this is from It's Time to Grow and Learn, who I think is very much a sort of MGTOW type MRA. He's got all these questions about. Here it is. Is it accurate to describe Western narratives and far-left talking points as female-centric? I mean, progressive terminology sounds like average millennial American young female. You take this one, because I've got views on this, but this is your stream, so you go for it.
So where's the question exactly? That Western narratives are quite female-centric?
And liberal politics, progressivism, is a female-centric way of looking at the world.
Yeah, sure, I would absolutely agree with that. I think liberalism is quite a threat. I think, as I said before, it lacks agency, it's got no drive, it sees the dominant order. You see, you get anarchists today, like, I'm not going to mention any names because that would be bad form, but they react from the state. You know, they're all for small state intervention. They're all over it. But whatever happens with the state, they will run away from it. I mean, I have many I was a libertarian for many years, for example, and I found that the philosophy itself and the ideology essentially had me cooked without realizing.
Because that's interesting in itself. We'll go into that afterwards, but concentrate on progressivism being female-centric just now.
Yeah, sure. It's definitely a feminine thing, and I'm in favour of balancing the masculine-feminine dynamic. But yeah, liberalism and the Western narrative today is certainly female-centric. I hope the MGTOW guy likes that answer.
Okay, so then to get onto libertarianism, then how did it cuck you?
Well, this might sound like a very banal example, but I used to run a chat site. And it wasn't very popular or anything like that, but people would come to me and say, I don't want this guy on this chat site because he's toxic or he's offensive or what have you. And even though he was, for example, that there were many of them, I would say, well, free speech, I can't discipline him. You know, I it would be wrong of me to just get shut of him based on nothing, just because of your feelings. So I would lose those people because I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't discipline. So as I say, it's a banal example, but
Yeah, I mean, I think libertarianism cucks you in other ways as well. It tells you basically that you don't have a group to fight for. So there's no point. And then the real good in life, the thing that matters most is personal liberty, and really any attachments or any duties get in the way of personal liberty. They impede your liberty. So
yeah.
Nationhood, race, religion, community, everything limits your personal liberty. So the sort of natural upshot of that is that you end up being an atomized individual, someone who has no attachments to anything except the consumerism, the free market, because that enables him to, well, that gives him so many choices, so many ways to enact his liberty. But they're all meaningless choices. That's the thing. It's all soulless.
It's all soulless. It's, as I say, it's a threat, but I would say the best way to describe liberalism and individualism is it's extremely childish. There is no sense of responsibility. I don't have any obligation to my neighbor because if he's acting like such and such, then that's nothing to do with me. Or, you know, this applies to the nation state. It's just ridiculously absurd. So that's why I moved away from it. So post-Brexit, I realized that it's not just about the economy. Civic nationalism is not in the least bit rewarding. So then I moved towards what you could say the dissident right. I had a sense of meaning, and it was more mature, more masculine. It encouraged me to take responsibility.
Yeah. Well, the other thing about libertarianism is that it encourages a certain deluded view of human nature, namely that all that people need is liberty. And if people are left to their own devices, they'll thrive and prosper. And so all, not just bureaucracy, but all frameworks, traditions, conventions, all of these things are in the way. And you know, it's a very optimistic, like on the left, it's an optimistic view of human nature, which I think is mistaken. So, yeah, that's the other thing I would say about libertarianism. It's like, it's in a sense, it shares with the left that optimistic view of human nature, strangely enough.
Yeah, it's two sides of the same coin. I mean, look at communism, look at liberalism. They're all chasing economics. You know, they are stuck in that very same paradigm. They operate on the same coin. Whereas the right, the real right wing is more metaphysical. It's more spiritual. It's less individualistic because it does enhance that responsibility. But as you say, the left and liberalism, it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah. So could you talk more about how the conservative revolution is relevant to the distant right today and how, well, maybe other texts that people could look into?
Sure. I would say that the most fundamental text of this movement would be Carl Schmitt's The Concept of the Political. He wrote it in 1932, and he basically outlines this idea of the friend-enemy distinction, wherein if you consider yourself to be in any way political, you are defined, your very existence is defined by having an enemy. So if you don't have any enemies, you're not political. There is nothing political about you, because if you join politics or if you're engaged in politics, you have to understand that you are going to be opposed to a certain group or a certain faction or certain individuals, and that's the most adult way of dealing with this. So it's kind of like it's a red pill in itself. So I would definitely advise that one. I've talked about Ernst Jünger, pretty much anything by Friedrich Nietzsche, certainly The Will to Power, which was his posthumous release. It talks a great deal about right-wing values and how to assert your own sense of agency. Any more? Yeah, I would say for now, they are more critical.
All right. And about the European Conservative Revolution, would you say that it brings a certain, would it be religious or nationalistic or racial? What does it bring to, what would it bring to, you know, the right today?
I think it would bring a certain sense of meaning and structure and a will to form a collective movement as itself. Not be so individualistic within the movement. Not be so concerned about purity spiraling. I mean, I do see a little bit of that in our movement now. Being a little bit more stoical, accepting the struggle, looking forward to the struggle. So our enemies are against us right now. I don't need to say who they are. I mean, we all know who they are. But we kind of look forward to this battle instead of reacting constantly saying, oh my God, look what they're doing now. Kind of move beyond that, transcend the reactionary values.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things, channels on YouTube that are still doing that. You know, and I always think, God, it's, yeah, I can understand this in 2014, 15. I was doing it then to some extent. But although even then, it wasn't really a surprise to me. But, you know, I still did it because you want to vent, you want to get it out of your system. But I think there are channels now and commentators now outside of YouTube who are now making a sort of bread and butter out of this constant pretend shock at what the left have done now. Just incredible. What have they done today, kind of thing, when it really shouldn't be a surprise, and you should have joined the dots and you should have understood, okay, now there has to be a more, you could say collective, or you could say orchestrated or intelligent response to them.
Yes, you hit the nail on the head. We have to be more intelligent and less shocked. I don't think anybody should be shocked within this movement. There's no reason to be shocked because they're very brazenly anti-us. They're very brazenly anti-European.
Yeah, they are. They're shamelessly so. Yeah.
Of course. So we should kind of accept the battle, as it were. we can't just go around saying, well, you know, what are we going to do in the year 2060? Well, we're going to have to do something now.
Yeah. There definitely does have to be this pushback. All right, well, before we end then, is there anything else you'd want? Oh, somebody asked, what would you say about Carl Schmitt?
I would say that he is very based and very pertinent to our movement. He's got so many complex ideas and thoughts going through him that I couldn't possibly do him justice by speaking about him as a synopsis. But yeah, the friend-enemy distinction is quite pivotal to our movement at this point in time. So read that book and get stuck in. If you'd like me to say any more, I will.
No, it's all right. Okay. And someone asks, are you aware of Armin Mueller's work? Is he recommendable for English-speaking readers? I'll send you that name on Telegram just so that you know who it is. I might not be pronouncing it correctly. There you go.
Armin Mueller. Yes, he was the historian of the RevCon movement. I haven't read any of his work so far, but I'm currently looking into him and Mueller van den Broek.
All right. Okay. And the other one was, oh, yes, It's Time to Grow and Learn says, just to say I'm not a MGTOW, I just think that female equality has cost our side everything we love about our homeland. All right. Okay. I take the point. I understand. I'm on record saying some pretty based things on this matter, so you don't need to convince me. But I also think that we have to look at masculinity as well, and the there is men of, and I'm not, believe me, I'm not being cocky about this. I'm just being thorough. Masculinity is also in a certain crisis. That's really how we got to this position in the first place. So I think, yeah, you can blame certain things on women having the vote or whatever, or having more of a say in society. But you've also got to look at how men have degraded, how they themselves have degraded, or rather how being a man and that the role of that notion in society has degraded over time. Because that's
that it's not very masculine to point the finger towards women for having equality.
Yes, exactly. Apart from anything else, we gave them equality, but also it's masculine to solve the problems yourself, not to sort of blame women. Now, that's not to say, and I want to make this clear because I don't want to get accused of being, a simp or whatever to women. I know, I do understand, but I'm saying that, it's up to us, basically.
It definitely is, yeah. It's.
All right, so any final things about the... here's another one. How do you cope with the fact that a nationalistic economy will have lower growth than its non-nationalist neighbours? If, for example, one country grows with 2% more than another, it will double within 35 years and 8 times within 100 years. How do you stop your people from moving to the degenerate, richer country? That's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. I'm not particularly strong on economics at all, but...
we can understand the point that people do enjoy wealth. So how would you... If your own protectionistic, nationalist country was poorer than Global Homo next door, how are you going to stop people from moving to Global Homo? Now, first of all, I don't think it should be a matter of looking for ways to stop them, but... Because then I think you've already lost, basically. But you should be looking at ways to, ways to persuade them. Because basically, you can go to Global Homo, but then your life, you will be living a life of meaninglessness, and your grandson will be twerking at a mixed race. And is that really what you want?
This is the thing, you see. You're assuming that people of the future, should they be on the right path, will be obsessed with wealth. It doesn't necessarily have to be the highest order. This is what I was talking about with transcending the material body. If we concentrate on, I don't want to use the word conditioning, but influencing people not to view a wealthy nation as superior or luxury, then we wouldn't be in this mess to begin with.
Oh, yes. I think that's probably true. Definitely part of the cucking of, you know, the European people has been that you make them care about wealth above all else. And it's the god of mammon, so to speak, where, as I said, it's just they just crave consumer choice and nothing else. I mean, it even sounds depressing and bad. Okay, here are some other questions that have just come in. Wouldn't you say that Ernst Jünger's The Forest Passage is also important, especially for our today's situation today as an opposition? The Forest Passage, have you read that?
No, I haven't. I would just like to say as well that I'm currently researching the project I'm doing right now. So any recommendations, please throw them in. I haven't read that particular work because I'm reading many at the moment, but I'll definitely look into it. And I'm sure it is very important in the Ernst Jünger bit.
Okay. And then someone said, oh, it's time to grow and learn, has struck again. And he says, really? I mean, it was a mistake or intentional sabotage in 1920 that the men who gave them the vote were the guys who sold us out, the men who passed the 19th Amendment and caved into the suffrage. Yes. All right. This is kind of, I understand that why you're concerned about this, why you're interested in this. I just think it's kind of too late. It's past the point where we should be pointing fingers. It doesn't really matter at this point. Yeah. I think my general point that masculinity has suffered and has degenerated, I think that's simply true, regardless of the circumstances along the way. And I also do agree that, you know, giving women the vote has resulted in society changing in certain directions. There's no question of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obvious. And I think they even knew that in advance. So, yes. And I think the left would say that today as well, that, if only men vote, then things will not be the way we want them to be. And they're right. They're correct. Mm-hmm. So,
is why I'm on here as well, because we're looking too much into the past. It doesn't matter, as you say, what we did in the 20s, that's gone.
Yeah.
We have to concentrate on the now and look into the future. Yes, we've made mistakes. Yes, things would have been better, or maybe not if we did this. Or this is a very, this is a very liberal way of looking at things. We need to be more proactive and rectify what we believe to have messed up.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's not to say that there's nothing to learn from the past. It just means that I don't think there's any point blaming or whatever at this point. It doesn't really matter anymore. Somebody's also asked you about, have you looked into Antoni Ludovici or Ludovici? I don't know. I think that'll
Ludovici.
Be. Let's see what that question was. Have you come across Antoni Ludovici?
I've only read his translations of Nietzsche. I read his, he wrote like a biography on Nietzsche, and it was very, very materialistic. Very eugenicist at the time, kind of Darwinist. But I know he's wrote his own philosophies. He did something on feminism. I read it briefly, but I kind of lost interest because I'm not really, you know, not really interested in looking at the feminist thing or coming from a right-wing perspective. But he's a very interesting figure indeed, and I would certainly recommend him. His translation of The Will to Power, Nietzsche's Will to Power, is top-notch. I recommend it.
All right. Okay, well, any final thoughts on the European Conservative Revolution then? Any final things you want to say to people before we finish?
Well, we have our own intellectual foundation. You have a reference point on my blog if you want the core-based literature. I've currently started a BitChute channel, and I intend to make a couple of videos, mainly like passages and reference points. So keep a lookout for that. But with regards to the revolution itself, look into it, understand how similar we are, and understand that we have a future with these actual intellectuals.
All right, excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much, Lone Wolf. I hope people do go and look at wolfofwoden.blogspot. I've linked it below. So please go and have a look. And is there a way to contact you there?
On Blogspot, no, but I will upload my email on top of the header there.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much. And I hope
thank you for having me on.
Yeah, you're welcome. I hope people look into this topic because it is something that I'd heard of, but I don't know much about. And I think that, you know, we can always do with more people going over this stuff and spreading it around. So excellent. Well, thank you very much. I'll be back in an hour with JF, and that should be quite interesting. It usually is. And okay, in the meantime, thank you for watching, and I'll see you later. And thank you, Lone Wolf, for taking part in Millennial 2020.
No problem. Thank you, guys.